Welcome to the Talaterra podcast. This is your host, Tanya Marion. I hope you've enjoyed learning from our guests these past few weeks. Today, we implement the second component of this podcast. I created this podcast to bring attention to the good work of freelance educators working in natural resource fields and environmental education. I also created it to bring attention to topics of interest to these educators. This episode is the first episode in which we discuss a specific topic with a special guest. Today, we discuss intercultural competency with an educator and researcher from Southern California. Today, my guest is Claudia Diaz-Carrasco, the 4-H Youth Development Advisor for the University of California Cooperative Extension in Riverside County, California. I met Claudia last year when I took her 5-week workshop called The Journey to Cultural Competence, Insights into the Latino Community. I spent some time speaking with Claudia about my freelance project, and I am thrilled to welcome her to this podcast. Thank you, Claudia, for making time for our conversation today.
Yeah, thank you for having me, Tanya.
As you know, I'm investigating the contributions that freelance educators in natural resource fields and environmental education make to their communities. And I assert that independent educators are uniquely positioned to create change in their communities, and that their ability to move through communities and engage with people where they are means that they have the potential to converse with an audience that is more diverse than one might find at a museum, a botanical garden, or a historical site. And so what I'd like to talk with you today about is how independent educators can learn to engage with diverse audiences and how they can work on developing intercultural competence, you know, on their own. I'd also like to talk about your program, your 4-H leadership program that you run for the University of California. Can you tell us about that program?
Yeah, so 4-H is a program that has been in the U.S. communities for over 100 years. It was funded through the U.S. Department of Agriculture. And it's delivered like nationwide in different counties through our land grant university systems. So in California, the University of California Agriculture and Natural Resources is the one in charge of delivering this program in our communities. And so the 4-H mission is to really engage youth in all the areas, providing them life skills, hands-on learning experiences for them to become leaders of their communities. At the same time as we're trying to advance the field of youth development. And we do this leadership training of life skill training through three different areas, which are our science, technology, engineering, and math programs, our healthy living programs, and our citizenship programs, which are the ones that the USDA mandates for us to do. And so here in Riverside and San Bernardino, I have been working with the 4-H program for the last 4 years. And one of the first missions that I took over was really the challenge of like expanding and diversifying our program. Traditionally, 4-H have served like rural audiences. And, you know, Riverside and San Bernardino are such like diverse in not only like rural, suburban and urban areas, but also like of the different places where the people that lives here come from. And so for me, it has been like, you know, a perfect opportunity to merge my passion to creating future leaders at the same time that I'm able to do research on cultural competence and extending the knowledge from my research to people in our communities that are working with youth, whether it's in a library staff, whether it's like in the after school setting, whether it's like in summer camps or day camps. And that's how the series that you were part of last year came from, you know, really in an attempt from the University of California to empower, you know, other educators to our research. And so, you know, it's my pleasure to be here. And I, you know, as you were mentioning, and please, if you need me to clarify on anything, just go ahead and and asked me about it. But it's, I really think that freelance educators play like a critical role. And as you were mentioning, is like reaching to all these people that formal education settings are not currently reaching. You know, like I'm really fortunate to be hired and for the university, the UCANR, just to really looking for expertise on the areas that we were lacking, like diversity and also 4-H programs in urban areas. But really, there is a lot of organizations that are not able to hire an expert on those settings, you know, and I do feel that oftentimes our educators in the after school settings or free educators, like is your case, and I assume the audience that listen to this podcast, you know, people want to empower themselves, they want to have new knowledge, but then it's like, where do I start, especially with topics like cultural competence that speak so much to our inner self. In my experience, a lot of educators, we end having, you know, like our in the classroom or like, you know, in our teaching mode when we want to be like good role models for our students and we want to transfer like the best of our knowledge and ability to them. But when it comes to culture, is like, you know, what do I transmit and what are the eyes that I see the world and how sometimes intentionally or not intentionally the way that we see the world that impacts the way that we educate. And so really cultural competence, you know, there is like different models and different authors that talk about building this competency in our educators. But I think the one thing that most of the models agree upon is in having this self-awareness. And so, you know, most of my work is how can we help our educators to start having that self-awareness of who they are and how they show up into the classroom, into the camp setting, you know, into the nature hike or whatever, you know, the field trip leader, any role that they are playing in front of the youth, how they are bringing themselves, but also how their lenses, so youth experience in nature.
I want to have a conversation about how independent educators can learn to engage with diverse audiences. Because the independent educators work so much in informal learning environments, you know, outside of school, how can educators do this on their own? What would be the smart way for them to even start this on their own?
Yeah, I mean, you know, kind of that's a loaded question. So I first do want to just for the audience clarify a little bit, you know, like me being like an employee from the University of California Ag and Natural Resources, you know, like I do work in the realms of higher education, you know, and part of my job is doing these research publications of whatever. But at the same time, you know, I really am a community-based researcher. So, like, I do have staff and volunteers that donate their time for us to be able to have after-school programs in our local school districts to host, like, again, day camps during the summer or summer camps, overnight experiences. And so, like, for me, it's kind of really interested to live, like, in the merging of these two areas, you know, whether, like, some people have access to higher education and go to traditional institutions, but they're also having these community-based organizations tied to provide services to the youth that is needed. I mean, and definitely in California, we have like a wide variety of diversity, not only again for like the places where people live, come from, but also like a diversity of environment, you know, like a diversity of socioeconomic status. And so I think it's critical for every freelance educator to recognize and to get to know that the community they are living or the community they are willing to work. And for me, that will be the first thing. As you know, a lot of authors recognize, especially when we are trying to serve diverse communities, it's really we cannot do it alone. And I think that's often the probably the oversight that a lot of big institutions like the University of California or 4-H or any of our local programs, like you know, Boys and Girls Scouts, our local community clubs, is like we all try to do the things in our own. And really what research shows us is that there is a strength on collaboration. What I find particularly important when you talk to me about this project is that big organizations or the organizations that came to mind when it comes to after school or out of school times programs, you know, there is like some anchored organizations, bid organizations, branded organizations that, yeah, they may have the kids with them, but honestly, they don't have the expertise Like when it comes to environmental education, to nature hikes, to really providing this hands-on experience for the youth, oftentimes this organization employ college students that are looking for like a part-time job. They do like a wonderful work engaging in the students, you know, sharing experiences of being the face-to-face. They have like the high energy just to be in the classroom. But oftentimes these people didn't have like kind of the experience for themselves to develop programs. And I think that for me, that's why freelancers can play a critical role. When generally it's like people that have followed their passion, that they have like a high knowledge of expertise in a specific topic. And I think that when they're able to align their expertise with any need that these after school programs may have, it's a strength for both of them. For you guys to be able to train other after school staff or you know, to design like a tailored program for these institutions, but also to deepen in the language of the schools. You know, like I always use this example when I start working, partnering with educators for me to be able to expand the science contents of 4-H is like, you know, if I take someone outside to see a tree in the school setting for the kids, I can only talk about the main parts of a tree. You know, this is the bark, this is the leaves. But someone that has really spent years of their life like doing youth programs or environmental education programs can have like a way more engaging way to do it. And so I think, again, just sometimes the organizations may have the resources, but they don't have the expertise. And I think that freelancers often have like highest levels of expertise, but they don't necessarily have the resources to impact the life of many youth. And I think for me, that's the key. And that's kind of like when we can align the strategies of saying educators, you know, what you can offer and how can we make it work so your expertise really goes longer. In terms of impact, I think like at the end of the day, both freelancers and programs that are serving youth and families in our communities, they want to have impact and they want more people to experience these programs or more people to acquire this knowledge. And I think that intersection is kind of something that often we don't explore closely.
So one thing that the educators could do is to partner with local organizations. But how should these independent educators approach potential partners? How could they establish a rapport and build trust and understanding with the community partners?
I think something that is critical, especially, you know, in our communities is really being able to identify what community needs. You know, often like universities or partners like are driven by needs assessments, but I really, the more the freelancer is immersed in their community and can demonstrate like a need of, you know, which places are not reaching in. Again, we have like kind of sometimes organizations like this blind, you know, this blindness on us that we are so immersed in our research or like the objectives or like the grants that we're receiving that we often like overlook what is really the community needs. Again, like I'm being part of the Langland University. The university has like this mission to extend the research, but private universities doesn't have that mission. You know, other programs, they are just trying to go through the day to day. But I think, something that I always find value when I partner with independent educators is when I see the need in the communities and organization and the people that I want to partner with or the freelancers has already recognized that the need. Oftentimes these freelancers have the time to already develop a program and to have a proposal. And so kind of oftentimes they come to me with solutions and say like, hey, you know, like I have, you know, if the workshop that you were part of was specifically that, like, you know, this community organization saying, you know, I recognize that there is a staff need to develop the cultural competence. And I know that I don't have the expertise to do that training, but I'm looking into you as a higher education institute to provide that for us. And for me, it was doing the same thing. Like, you know, I want to have people to work with the youth in our communities that have acquired this competence. And so, like, I'm willing to provide some of my time to create that space of professional development. But it's, I think we're not the easiest way to align, you know, a strategy, because all partnerships, you know, the partnership development process, unfortunately, it takes time. But I really think that that time spent pays back, whether you're trying to develop partnerships first with a community so you get to know them. You know, I mean, especially being a freelance educator, sometimes it's like, well, you know, I'm spending all these times with the community and nobody's really like retributing me for that. But once you develop that expertise, I really think that it's something that pays back. At the same time, that if you're trying to develop partnerships with an institution, just getting to know what are their mission goals, what are their yearly objectives, and really speaking to those, to the leadership, for me, it's always like the best practice to align the strategies.
And how should independent educators think about equity in informal learning environments? Because it's more than just bringing a tried and true activity to a new audience. And what considerations should be made before this?
Yeah. Well, there is, you know, five principles that basically there was like a task force in the division that I worked for like a couple of years ago. To be able to review the literature and say like kind of what programs need to be doing in order for them to be equitable and to really serve, reach out to people. So, you know, equity, it's, first of all, I think I guess my first, and this is just coming to the top of my mind, is having a good understanding of what equity means. And I think that's a concept that is often misunderstood in literature. I provide this picture for the people that is listening. And I love this image for one of our state directors. There is like kind of three guys that they are different heights trying to look across a football field. You know, and so depending on the height of these kids, they're going to need a different size of box behind their feet to be able to just overlook through the fence so they can see the football game. And so, I mean, for me, that's one of the best definitions of equity that I can find, because that doesn't mean that everybody gets the same. It just means that everybody get the right box for them to get to the place that they need to be. And so when it comes to independent educators, you know, again, I guess the first thing is building their own equity perspective. Oftentimes the programs that they are called to work for, they don't have this equity perspective. And so when I look into that equity lens, for example, when I'm looking into partnerships for the 4-H program, there is like four pieces that emerge from the literature that I always use to determine like, hey, you know, I do want to go and partner to this program or I don't want to. So one of those underpinnings is having an understanding, you know, a comprehensive understanding of youth development. And for me, what that means is that extensive understanding of positive youth development means that is you only don't have the youth in the center, but they recognize that the youth is part of a family and there is as well part of a community. So like, for example, you have a student that show up into my classroom and they may have experienced hunger at home. I need to understand that I'm not going to address the youth and I'm just going to help him do the homework, but I might also need to provide a snack because what he's experiencing at home. You know, I mean, I'm not going to like shame this student. So that's for me, it's like an extended understanding of youth development. So you end becoming not only like a program provider, but really to be have in mind that the organizations that you are working are having this wraparound approach. And again, after school programs, for example, in the school districts are really good doing that. If you are coming in as an educator, they already take care of all those pieces. They already giving them a healthy snack. They already provide transportation for the youth to be there. But that's kind of one of the pieces is like if the organization that is calling me to do this work as independent educator has this extended understanding of what the youth needs. You know, so that's one of the things that we follow. The other principle that we follow is content with psychological and social effects of discrimination. Unfortunately, you know, a lot of the kids in our schools, they do face these social effects of discrimination. And so when we are creating a program or where you are deciding a program as an independent educator, it's just like, you know, making sure that you are taking in account experiences that the youth and the youth community may have. You know, we in San Bernardino, we work with a lot of English as a second language learners. There is like, there's probably going to be some words in the programming that these kids are not going to be able to catch up at the first time or may not be able to pronounce. And so that can educator be able to to look out for those examples when the kid is trying to participate and he's not having fun of that. Again, it's kind of, I cannot pinpoint you a specific examples because the variety of the programs that independent educators can work like is infinite. But really the realm or the guiding principle is like, how can I contain the psychological and social effects that kids are experiencing in this program? And the example that I always use when we are working with educators is, you know, for example, don't assume that every kid has seen the ocean. You know, that's not the truth of our communities in Southern California. You know, some kids have might gone, some others have not gone. And so just kind of being mindful of what are you going to bring into the classroom, which topic is going to see, and how can you make sure that the kids, you know, the examples are relatable to the kids, not only to your own life experience. And that's for me, that's the critical of self-awareness, like recognizing that what you have gone through your life might not be the reality of the kids that you are teaching. And so in the teaching, how are you contending with the social effects that they may have for discrimination? Other thing that we try always to focus is in the support of positive ethnic identity development. And again, I think like, especially when it comes to teenage age programs, you know, kids start developing their identity and they do that through the affiliation of different groups. They do that, you know, having the sense of belonging to the school or to a sports or for anything that is in their life. But the other thing that is really important for organizations to keep in mind is like the ethnic identity and how we foster this ethnic identity in our programs. In 4-H, you know, most of my work focuses on that. You know, how can we bring up like cultural celebrations to the day-to-day programming? You know, for example, Mother's Day. Mother's Day in Mexico celebrated always like May 10th versus, you know, different dates in the States. And so again, like, how can I recognize the different places of the different cultural traditions that the kids may have? You know, I'm Mexican, so most of the times I use examples from Mexican culture, but how can we mix like day of the day to create like a ethnic identity for kids in my program? And how does that relate to the other content that I'm trying to say? You know, sometimes we use the date of the dead to create poem, and that's helping literacy the students. So, you know, you're bringing like a culture piece to a literacy piece that needs to be covered at the school. Other thing that is really important, and it's probably that's the challenge for independent educators, and that's what I always ask them to do partnerships, is how programs respond to economic poverty. In order for a program to be equitable, they need to be able to respond to the economic poverty that their participants may or may not be experiencing. You know, and so this is the part when programs that are equitable do make sure that all the students have transportation to make it to the place where the meeting is, that they make sure that they provide any snacks or food for the students that I may not have experienced that. You know, programs are providing supplies for the students instead of expecting every student to come with their own ruler or scissors or things that for some communities might be like not big deal, but from other communities, they may not participate in a program just because they didn't have the supplies that they were asked to bring at a school. And then the final point that it's always like a challenge is how can you tailor the specific experiences, resources, needs, and interests to the local Latino youth. And so I remember one of my first attempts to do an environmental education program was here in Southern California doing a program for in a school that I was like in Hemet. And we wanted to use a curriculum that I was like closely developed like in a forest land. So like, you know, a lot of the activities, like the trees in the forest are way different. You know, the trees in San Bernardino Forest are completely different to the nature that you can experience in Hemet or in the Coachella Valley. And so, you know, yes, we want to teach them about environmental education, but we want them to be relevant to the things that they, places that they live around. And so that's like a really simplistic example, but it truly happened. You know, once we have choose the curriculum, we realize, well, this is a forest-based curriculum, and our kids are living closer to the desert than in the forest. But that is kind of, so we do recognize that we need to tailor our efforts to the specific experiences and resources that this community had. And, you know, not even like a program for 4-H that has 100 years of tourists can do it in our own. Like, you know, I partnered with around like 20 to 25 organizations in a yearly basis to be able to ensure that our programs are tailoring the efforts are responding to economic poverty, are being a spaces for ethnic identity development, are contending social effects for discriminations, and they are incorporating this extended understanding of youth development, which includes the family and the community and not only the youth. So for me, that's kind of like the shifter that I use when I'm trying to develop partnerships, like recognizing what 4-H cannot do, and then looking in the community for organizations that I cover one of these 5 points.
Mm-hmm. Yes, thank you. That's a very good points. Thank you. And how is your project coming along?
Well, you know, so 4-H in Riverside and San Bernardino County, so we have like 4 main program streams, if you may call it. We have our community club program, which is highly volunteer-based. We also have our college and career readiness programs, which are based on local high schools and are helping low-income students get the resources that they need to get into college. We also have leadership programs during the summer, which we have like team-based teams of teenagers leading camps for younger youth. And that's like a main component of our leadership experience of 4-H. And we have like all these school enrichment programs for environmental education that we do in 4-H. So definitely, like, as I was telling you, these principles are not something that is like a cookie cutter and say, you know, the way that I respond to economic poverty in the community clubs are completely different to the way that we respond to economic poverty during the summer. And so I'll give you some examples for 2 of them. So our community clubs are mainly run by adult volunteers. We have around 1,000 youth involved in this program every year in 4-H. And transportation and meals are never an issue in our community club program. So the majority of the demographics in this program are like middle-income youth. And so, you know, parents take turns to bring a snack to each meeting. So there may be a kid that, you know, their parents never show up to the meeting and therefore they are never asked to bring a snack. But if these kids come hungry, there is going to be a snack available for him. And also, like, there is such sense of different parents helping other parents that they give rights among themselves. So it doesn't have any cost to my organization to ensure that kids that are participating in this program have transportation. Because the clubs are a mixture of low-income and middle-class youth that helps each other around. So, you know, so in that program, most of my efforts are on creating ethnic identity development. And again, like if they are going to have a holiday party in December, make sure that it's not a Christmas party, you know, because we do have kids that doesn't celebrate this religious holiday. You know, and yes, it's okay to talk about holidays with the youth, but it's kind of like our job to make sure that we're talking about Hanukkah and Christmas, you know, and just like a holiday break, you know, and so that's kind of one of the examples of my programs. Differently to our college and career readiness programs, where we are based in local high schools and we work predominantly with low-income youth, in those meetings, like part of my job is actually fundraise to be able to provide food in these meetings. We have given kids like Uber cards because most of the kids, they have parents that work, you know, different shifts. And so instead for us providing transportation, we just like make a student time agreement and we give them like an Uber card so they can make sure that they have transportation from the meetings and back. These clubs are meeting also sometimes during the school time. So that's where we can ensure that a school is providing lunch for them. So for me, it's really hard to talk about specific examples for programming because it becomes so unique to the community. So like when you know, going back to your question about what would a freelancer educator should do or how can they better support, you know, efforts in the communities. So one piece of it is like having, you know, a knowledge of the community. And I think that's always going to ground you in doing like meaningful programs for whoever you want to serve. The second time is having that self-awareness and knowing, you know, kind of where is your passion, what is your expertise, and then which type of population you're willing to work with and which population you are not willing to work to. And so because that self-awareness is going to totally determine the type of partnerships that you're willing to create. And so then the third step, after, you know, you know, your community, you know, what is your expertise, and then you are looking for organizations that want to support you in this endeavor, is aligning that strategic thinking. So for me, like in all of the Forge program, that's the majority of my work, just looking into my community, who has the resources that I don't have, how can I foster this partnership? I mean, we have seen increase, like overall, really thanks to the efforts that we have doing in the office, and like really the amazing thing that we were able to build here. When I received the Forge program 4 years ago, we have around like 600 youth in Riverside County. I'm just going to use Riverside County as an example. Today, we have created this different set of programs, and we're serving around 5,000 youth annually. Not only the numbers of the program have increased, but also the diversity. You know, just at the top of my mind, we used to have around like 10 to 15% of Latino youth. Now we're having like a big issue, because last year I would report we were serving like 69% of Latino youth. And, you know, our youth population is around 50%. So we were basically over-serving Latino youth in the program. And so I'll see some increases as the program has increased. We have like greater funding challenges. You know, it's not the same thing serving 600 youth than 5,000. And so, you know, I'm really moving forward to do like fundraising campaigns and some, you know, fee by service contracts with people. But overall, what I really value is just be able to collect real data from the communities. You know, we did have this literature review, and we have these five principles that emerge from the literature and say like, hey, you know, you need to provide ethnic identity development. You need to respond to economic poverty, but I didn't know how that is going to look into a community program. And so for these 4 years, informally and formally, we have been collecting data. And so now I know, you know, some examples of how we can respond to economic poverty in different organizations. And it could be as simple, like, for example, nobody learns in a hungry stomach. And so, like, if you are going to be called to do, like, a day camp, for example, there is places in the community that offer, like, free lunches during the summer, like libraries. So if you are doing that as a independent educator and you want to create something for the summer, it's like, well, you know, I'm not going to go and do it by myself. I'm just going to find a library that has like the free lunch program, and I'm going to have my program right after all the students receive free lunch. So it's like you as an independent educator, you know, you don't need to fundraise for the food. You don't need to coordinate about all the food safety practices, but you are aware that if you want to have a equitable program, kids need to eat. And so, you know, it's probably just going to this site and say like, hey, you know, I know you're giving free lunches here and the kids are not going to have anything to do afterwards. Can we do some educational program here? So like it could be like as simple as that versus like saying like, you know, I'm just going to do the summer programming and now I need like $10,000 to serve this many kids. You know, a lot of the times when it comes to equity, it's like having access to safe spaces. There is like a spaces in our community that unfortunately may not feel safe for certain segments of our community. So it's like, well, I'm going to select a place where people, you know, like a library is generally a place that all families are familiar with and are willing to do, versus like a city hall that it will be threatening for some people. So again, like everything is based on how well you know your community, how well you know your expertise, recognizes when you need help. And what I always find, you know, cultural competence, I'm really happy when people say like, hey, you know, like I really don't know how to manage this segment of the population, or like I'm really afraid of doing that. And I think just bringing those things, those starting those conversations and recognizing the areas that we as educators feel uncomfortable, really brings value to the table. You know, again, for me, it's still like I'm getting to become comfortable working with the U.S. educational system. I didn't grow up in this country. So like in Mexico, we don't have a school districts like we have them here. You know, we don't have like a PTA meeting, like a formal, you know, we don't have a board of education. And so like sometimes when I'm going to a school settings, I recognize that I need to go with someone that has been raised here in the U.S. and can translate these organizational infrastructure pieces for me. So, you know, like, I don't know who is more important, if the president of the board of education or the principal, or I don't know which roles they play. And so just kind of really being able, you know, to have this self-awareness and say, like, where are we playing? Which arena I'm playing? And who do I need to talk to make a program happen is really that guides the day-to-day programming.
Yeah, that is fantastic work, Claudia. That's fantastic that your program has grown the way that it has in 4 years that you've been working in it. That is just impressive. You've worked with huge populations of youth and families. And, you know, I have this recurring conversation with other educators about people being afraid of nature. I was wondering, based on your experience, what have you noticed or observed that creates anxiety with people when it comes to nature or being outdoors?
You know, in my experience, and I went so the people in the audience know, I work predominantly with low-income Latino youth. With this particular segment of the population, really one of the fears is, you know, not knowing. Like, you know, when I think about, you know, my kid just going and touching plants or like climbing a tree, like there's always the normal fear that a parent has, like, are they going to fall? Like, you know, are they going to touch something? I have an allergy. For me, it really is like one, not knowing about what really means being with the nature. You know, I have like all types of questions from parents, like, you know, we say that we're going to do a field trip, and then like all of a sudden the parents say, like, do they need to wear a raincoat and raining boots, and do they need to, like, almost they want to have like a whole you know, like a lab coat or anything, like, for them to be able to go to a field trip. And it's like, no, we're just gonna go like in a nature hike. All they need is comfortable shoes and sunscreen, like, you know. So like I think one of the challenges is just being more specific of what it means to take a kid to the nature. You know, I once have a field trip taking some kids to the river, and there's like, is my kid is going to drown in the river? You know, like parents, I mean, and it's human nature just to go to the catastrophic scenario. So when we are inviting a new community to like experience the outdoors, just being clear, like, hey, you know, we're going to go to whatever forest, like, you know, or we're gonna go to this local park, and we are gonna do a walk, like, you know, or and we are gonna do games. Just kind of really being specific, that's something that I have helpful with the parents. Also always providing safety guidelines. I think like for any activity that is not like the day-to-day after school program or camp or whatever, if you hand up to the parents, like, you know, a handout that has like 5 bullets and say, like, for your safety, wear comfortable shoes and wear sunscreen and bring a hat, and kind of these things, they make parents aware that you are recognizing that they are safety procedures that needs to be followed, and that you are aware of those and you're letting them be aware of those. That generally helps reduce anxiety with the families that I work with. And then really the third piece, like, sometimes the anxiety is not related to nature, is like, who is going to be leading my field trip? And there are some communities that have no problem trusting someone in a position as authority, like a teacher. Some communities don't have, and they just recognize a teacher as an authority. And so I think it's really a problem when we haven't built a relationship with our communities or with our parents, and then we all of a sudden send, like, you know, a piece of paper letting the parents sign off here because your kid is going to go here and where. Often the question that I get for parents is like, who is going to be the leader? What expertise do they have? What education do they have? Or, you know, there is, depending on the cultural background, generally, or what I have found in the research is that, you know, middle-class white communities are okay just knowing, like, oh, he's a third-grade teacher and has this position of authority, and that seems to be calming for them. Like, a Latino family is going to want to know the name and the last name and who is the grandma of whoever is going to be the field trip leader, you know? So it's just like a relationship-based community. And so they need to know when they are going to sign the paper, they need to have in their minds the face of who is going to be and how do these people got here. You know, definitely if you are like an educator that never say like hello and good night, or I like, you know, like your kid do this today at class, if you haven't pre-established that relationship, it's going to be really hard for families. And so, like, you know, again, like, I'm not giving you a concise answer, but, like, there's some, I think, like, the three main things that I experience when working with youth in outdoor spaces is, like, safety concerns, they're not having a relationship with the people who is in charge, per se, of the trip. And then just, like, kind of not knowing the exact activities. You know, again, when I send a flyer that says, let's visit the Santa Ana River, you know, parents don't even know that the Santa Ana River is have so much invaded species, and there is, like, it's not even deep in the places that you can access them because it's contaminated, you know, it's not even safe to get into the water. So what we're going to do is just go and look into the pollution. Like, you know, we're not going to let the kids go inside. But it's like all these things that happen in a parent's mind, and if kind of your communication is not clear and concise, then they are just going to say no. So it's time consuming. I have had to spend, like, you know, several minutes with a parent saying, like, you know, I really want Nathan to go to this field trip, and it's important because it covered this content of the science class. And really all we're going to do is, like, you know, to collect water samples. But really all we're going to do is to watch into invasive species. And so just having that conversation, sometimes parents say, like, yes, it's okay for my kid to go. And sometimes they have say, like, no, you know, I think they are too young. Or sometimes I have parents tell me, like, yeah, I will let her know, but if the brother goes with her. And so I think other things that I didn't mention on those principles is really finding that flexibility and adapting the program to whatever the community is telling you to do. I have tried both things, programs where only the youth is involved and programs where the youth and families is involved. When I'm working with Latino audiences, the family approach generally works better. It just increases participation. It decreases anxiety on all participants. And so when I have funding available to include the whole family, that's always my my strategy to go around it.
Well, Claudia, thank you so much. It's very helpful, and I am sure it's given listeners plenty to think about, and you've sparked some ideas, I'm sure. So thank you so much. Do you want to learn more about intercultural competence? Visit the show notes for this episode to learn about a professional development opportunity for freelance environmental educators. You'll find the show notes at talaterra.com.